This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, the Supreme Court cleared the way for the execution of Troy Davis, a death row inmate from Georgia convicted in 1991 of the murder of off-duty police officer Mark McPhail in Savannah. Davis has always maintained he is not guilty and spoke last year from prison.
I want my innocence proved one way or another. That's key and foremost. I don't want to die, especially for a crime I didn't commit. I want to make sure that the McPhail family has justice, but accurate justice.
7 of 9 key prosecution witnesses recanted their original testimony and swear they were pressured to testify by police. Pope Benedict and former President Jimmy Carter are among many who ask for clemency. And for Troy Davis's supporters, the case raises basic issues of fairness. Officer McPhail's family and prosecutors remain convinced of Davis's guilt. Every court that's heard his appeal turned him down. Later in the program, we want to hear from those of you who've traveled overseas and have been asked about this year's presidential campaign. You can send us email now. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, the Troy Davis case. And we're not talking about the pros and cons of the death penalty per se today. We're talking about the process. Is this fair? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Jeffrey Rosen, law professor at the George Washington University and legal affairs editor of The New Republic, with us here in Studio 3A. Always nice to have you on the program, Jeffrey.
Good to be back.
It was a dramatic moment. The Supreme Court granted Troy Davis a stay of execution, when I think just a couple of hours before he was set to be killed by the state. Do we know why they decided to hear the case, at least temporarily?
The decision to grant the stay wasn't that unusual. There was at least enough of a legal issue to force the court to talk about it. But the fact that they then lifted the stay without comment, and most important of all, with no dissenting opinions, suggests that they decided the case wasn't legally close after all. It turns out that the standard for granting new trials, even in situations like this, is extraordinarily high. The Supreme Court said in 1995 that you have to establish by a fair probability that the trier of fact would have entertained a reasonable doubt about guilt. So you basically have to be more likely innocent than not. And I think that they concluded, given the fact that so many state and federal courts had reviewed this recantation evidence, 29 courts by some evidence, at least 2 eyewitnesses did not recant. There was some other physical evidence supposedly tying him to the crime. For all these reasons, there wasn't a fair probability that he was actually innocent, and they decided to let it go ahead.
How much review might they have given it? Do we know?
Well, they could have ordered a new trial, which is indeed what the dissenting justices on the Georgia Supreme Court argued. The dissenting justices said, basically, the standard is too high. The question isn't, was it likely that the evidence was completely fabricated? That's too high a standard. But that basically, if there's some possibility that perhaps the guy is innocent in light of evidence that hasn't been adequately reviewed in court, there should be a new trial. They basically said, at least test these witnesses, put them on the stand and let the jury decide.
Would this court have been just judging the fairness of the trial, or would they have been looking at this as a constitutional issue?
As a constitutional issue, and this is very important to the death penalty jurisprudence, which seems so counterintuitive. How is it possible that if someone might be innocent, he could be executed? The court has said again and again, their job as a constitutional court isn't to review the facts. Basically, they're just supposed to review the law, because if they reviewed the facts, then in every death penalty case, someone would come up at the last minute and say, here's some new evidence. So that's why they, in their case law, and also, this is important, reading the will of Congress. Remember, it was in the 1990s that the Congress, under President Clinton's direction, passed a death penalty act that really cut back on the discretion of the Supreme Court and other courts to hear newly discovered evidence in lots of ways. For all these reasons, that's why the court sets the bar so high and says there has to be a fair probability of innocence, not just some possibility that the fairness of the trial is in question.
This trial was held in 1991. As you suggest, this has not exactly been a rush to the execution chamber.
It hasn't. It's been reviewed by 29 courts by some measure at both the state and federal level. The Supreme Court has already turned down an opportunity to review the case a couple years earlier. And the supporters of the execution say much of this newly discovered evidence, the newest affidavits, were just put together weeks before the clock was supposed to tick on the final execution, suggesting that these people should have come forward earlier if they'd really had serious doubts.
And is there any avenue left for appeal?
Not to my knowledge. The governor can, of course, always issue a pardon, but...
Or commute the sentence.
Commute the sentence, forgive me. But the Supreme Court, I think, is not likely to intervene again unless there's some new legal theory or some dramatic new evidence, but that doesn't seem very likely in this case.
And is this unusual that these kinds of last-minute maneuverings in death penalty cases?
Not at all. Of course, good lawyers will try to bring whatever evidence they can. But the question of can an innocent man be executed, that obviously has tremendous public resonance. And the remarkable thing is the Supreme Court has not squarely said no. It's suggested as much. It's assumed that to execute an innocent person would violate the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Several justices have said they believe that. But because the court has not squarely held that, a lot of people are thinking, well, this really is a situation where the court should make itself clear.
Joining us now is Robert Blecker. He's a law professor at New York Law School, and he joins us from our bureau in New York City. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
And I know that you are a believer in the death penalty, but you have reservations about this particular case.
Well, of course, I'm a believer in the death penalty only for those who deserve it.
Of course. I'm not arguing that you're not.
I have reservations, but I'd like to just clarify something that Professor Rosen just said. He said, in effect, what the court is demanding is that we are convinced is that the defendant must show it more likely that he's innocent than not. I would take issue with that. What the court is really saying is that it has to be shown more likely than not that no reasonable juror would have found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I know these are a lot of words and there's a lot of complexity involved, but there's a big difference between what Professor Rosen just said and what I reiterated as the court's standard.
So forgive me, I had initially read it correctly. A fair probability that the trier of fact would have entertained a reasonable doubt of his guilt. That's from the case in 1995. And
correct.
That's what I meant to say.
Would have entertained a reasonable doubt. So let's be clear about what we're talking about as we talk about fairness. Has the defendant convinced us, the convicted defendant convinced us, that it is more likely than not that a reasonable juror would have a reasonable doubt? Not more likely than not that he's innocent, but more likely than not that a reasonable juror would have a reasonable doubt. That's a much lower threshold than requiring him to prove it more likely than not that he's innocent. A much lower threshold.
And do you think the Troy Davis case meets that threshold?
Given all the evidence that has come to light and discounting it for its implausibility and for the fact that when witnesses recant, they often lie, I think that it doesn't meet it in terms of a new trial. But I have problems, as you identified, I have problems with the case. I have personal problems with the case. Although the legal standards were followed, and Professor Rosen is quite right, and they are quite complex, my problem is that I morally require something higher than proof beyond a reasonable doubt before we put someone to death. I would require proof to a moral certainty that he deserves it and no residual doubt that he did it, no lingering doubt. And if you take all the evidence, and I'm not an expert in this case, I've not interviewed the witnesses. The trial transcript is voluminous. It's been through court after court after court, as has been said. But my sense of it, insofar as I've reviewed it, and if you take into account all the witnesses' changed statements, is that if I were a juror, I would have a lingering doubt as to his guilt. I would probably convict because I would be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, but I would not sentence him to die because I would have a lingering doubt as to whether he did it. And thus, in my view, that's my problem with it. I couldn't execute him as a juror.
But you're talking about a standard which, so far as I know, does not really exist for the sentencing phase of this case.
That's correct, although the dissent, Professor Rosen correctly points to the key opinion, which was the Georgia Supreme Court's opinion in which they divided 4-3 over whether he should get a new trial. And the majority, as Professor Rosen said, and I think rightly, the majority came up with what I think is a ridiculous standard. They said, in essence, in order to set aside a verdict, there can be, quote, no doubt of any kind that the state's witness testimony in every material part is purest fabrication. Now, that's a standard that is almost impossible to meet. And the dissent disagreed with it, and in my view, rightly so. And right at the end of their opinion, what they said is that the collective effect of all the new testimony, if there were a hearing and if the trial court found it to be credible, might show either that there was a new jury would find a reasonable doubt or his guilt, and then the last part of the sentence is key, or at least sufficient residual doubt to decline to impose the death penalty. So the three dissenting justices of the Georgia Supreme Court, in effect, signaled that for them, the question of residual doubt was significant. And reading between the lines, I would say that for them, they think that a reasonable juror, as I think, that a reasonable juror, given all this evidence, would probably have a residual doubt about his guilt.
So let me ask you sort of a hypothetical question, and that is, if in controversial cases like this one, we proceed to execution, does it undermine support for the death penalty?
Well, it will undermine support for the death penalty once it's conclusively shown that we've in fact executed an innocent person in the modern era. I believe we have. I have no idea who it is. It's never been demonstrated that we have. It seems highly probable that we have. Now, Troy Davis, if he's to be executed, and he probably will be next Monday, Professor Rosen points out that the governor can pardon, but the governor has more or less given that power to the parole board.
Which has reviewed the case already.
In detail, and did consider the testimony and did hear from those witnesses that the defense attorneys wanted to present to them, and decided not to issue clemency. So it's unlikely that the governor will step in, since the parole board has not. Now, you ask me, will it undermine confidence? If it's later shown that Troy Davis was factually innocent, of course it will. If it's later shown that anybody who was executed will, it will. But to say that it undermines confidence is not the same as to say that it gives us sufficient reason to abolish the death penalty.
Jeffrey, I wanted to hear you on this.
Well, now, of course, it's not obvious that the Roberts Court would even take the rather rigorous view that we've been discussing. These are old cases, and conservative justices have said that even that fair probability standard that we talked about is too generous, that basically it undermines confidence that for the death penalty if these things are delayed, and no reasonable juror should be able to vote for death in order to get a new trial. So this is a contested issue, and certainly these cases are very, very contentious.
We're talking about the case of Troy Davis. He's exhausted his appeals and awaits execution in Georgia. The prosecutor in the case had been barred from talking about any details in public as long as the case was on appeal. Now he's free to speak. He'll join us next. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the case of Troy Davis, 17 years ago sentenced to death for the murder of an off-duty police officer in Georgia. He's since exhausted his appeals but gathered the support of many who argued the process was not fair. Now the Supreme Court rejected Davis's final appeal. The district attorney overseeing the case is able to discuss details publicly. He'll join us in just a moment. Right now, our guests are Jeffrey Rosen, law professor at the George Washington University, legal affairs editor of the New Republic, also Robert Blecker, a law professor at New York Law School. We want to hear from you again, not a discussion about the death penalty per se, another conversation for another time. Today we're focused on the process in this case. Is this fair? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's begin with Jim, and Jim's with us from Birch Run in Michigan.
Yeah, this is pretty good. It is the process, and that's the problem. We go through all of these processes and all this litigation over and back and forth. We haven't affected nothing in the system. Why do we do this? Why don't we just put the guys in prison for the rest of their life? And I am personally not against the death penalty. But where are we going? We're doing nothing. We're accomplishing nothing but wasting money and time.
And enriching lawyers. Robert Blecker?
Yes, would that it were that easy. The public view of what it's like to spend a life in prison is different from the actual reality. As someone who has spent thousands of hours in maximum security prisons and on death rows in six states, I can tell you that in some ways I was appalled by the quality of life day to day when I watched lifers, convicted murderers, playing softball with lined base paths and umpires, when I watched them playing pool on reconditioned pool tables, when I watched them live a life that some people would only envy. the retributive part of me that demands justice is dissatisfied. You know, they'll never see the light of day. Well, if they'll never see the light of day, why does the commissary sell suntan lotion with an SPF factor of 30? So to say simply abolish the death penalty does not adequately raise the question of justice, which is what is the alternative? It's not just that one spends one's life. It's how one spends one's life. And it's nobody's job to punish. If you look at the Department of Corrections mission statements, not one in the United States ever mentions the word punishment. And for a host of reasons we can go into, mm-hmm. the officers, ranking and line officers, do not see it as any part of their job to punish. So the alternative to the death penalty is just as involved in the question of justice as the death penalty itself. What is the quality of life for lifers?
Jeffrey?
I think the caller's question gets back to this issue we were just discussing of whether public support for the legitimacy of the death penalty is itself undermined by these extensive procedures. And I agree with those who say it's fine to have it and to have these high standards for reexamining verdicts, but that means at the very least you have to have opportunities to present evidence of actual innocence. And that's why the Supreme Court needs to say clearly that it is cruel and unusual to execute an innocent person. And that's why groups like the Innocent Project insist that DNA evidence of innocence in death penalty cases should be treated differently than that in other cases. The Supreme Court has sort of contemptuously dismissed the so-called death is different idea. But of course it's different, and we really do need to ensure that innocent people are not executed.
By the way, I agree with Professor Rosen on that. I think the Supreme Court should announce that the Eighth Amendment absolutely prohibits, as cruel and unusual punishment, the execution of somebody who is factually innocent.
Jim, thanks very much for the phone call.
Well, thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. And we'd like to thank Robert Blecker for his time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Robert Blecker, law professor at New York Law School. He was the subject of the documentary Robert Blecker Wants Me Dead, in which he chronicles his unusual relationship with Daryl Holton, recently executed by the state of Tennessee. And he joined us from our bureau in New York City. And let's welcome now Spencer Lawton, Jr., the Chatham County District Attorney, with us by phone from his office in Savannah, Georgia. Nice to have you on the program today, sir.
Thank you very much.
And you wrote in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution this morning that many people are concerned that an innocent man is about to be put to death. I am not likewise concerned, however. Tell us why.
Well, I take as my point of departure, frankly, first the assumption that the trial was fair, as I believe it to have been. And then I turn my attention to the post-conviction activities, both in court and out. My particular attention is riveted by what has been an international firestorm of public relations campaigning on the part of people who, generally speaking, I think it's fair to say, are opposed to the death penalty, regardless of the guilt or innocence of the accused. And I think you referred earlier to the question whether... I think the way you put it was whether if an innocent person were put to death, it would erode the public's confidence in death penalty jurisprudence. I hope I have that correct.
Yeah.
I certainly think it would, and indeed I think it should. But if I may interject just this sort of slightly different view, I have so much enjoyed, by the way, the discussion that's preceded me. I feel a little in over my head. That's been very fascinating.
I suspect not, hardly so.
But I feel that we are not here debating, or at least from my perspective as a prosecutor in the case, debating how many angels can dance on the head of residual doubt. I think that a great deal of damage has already been done to the public confidence in the criminal justice system, though I have only anecdotal evidence for it, because of this public relations campaign that's gone on during a time when I, representing the state, have been unable to speak to the merits of the case. And so many people with only that information provided to them by what I might characterize, I hope fairly, as sometimes zealous opponents of the death penalty. For what it's worth, I'm not criticizing their opposition to the death penalty. I am myself, confessedly, at the very least ambivalent about it. But my point here is that we have, as a civilized society, we've substituted the rule of law for mob rule. I think any of us would be outraged if, while a court was trying to adjudicate guilt or innocence, a mob gathered outside the courthouse chanting and demanding vengeance. We would be utterly appalled. If the same, or, well, it would have to be a different mob, were to gather outside the courthouse chanting and demanding innocence, I think we would similarly be appalled. And the reason for that, obviously, is that we expect the court to go forward with its adjudication in accordance with the rule of law.
Mm-hmm. And you suggest that, in a way, that's what's been happening in this case. Let me just ask you.
I do suggest exactly that. Yeah. I don't mean to interrupt, but if there are two points particularly on which I think so. One is, and this is what I think is the nub of the issue, when you strip the scholarship out of it, which, as I say, I've so much enjoyed, the issue of the recantations. I think we're dealing with a general perception in an enormous swath of the public who's interested in this, that it's impossible for this many people to have recanted and something not be done about it.
Yes.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. 7 out of 9 of the key witnesses, yeah.
Well, my observation on that, a couple of things. I start with the idea that 7 out of 9 is intuitively persuasive. To me, it's not. To me, an 80% recantation rate, some 12 to 17 years after the conviction, is suggestive of some sort of, frankly, of manipulation.
And this being done then by those same opponents of the death penalty you mentioned earlier?
I really can't say by whom, but it's just as I think I said in the piece you referred to earlier, it is at least an uncanny coincidence.
That piece, by the way, you can find a link to it on our website at npr.org/blogofthenation. But please go ahead if you would, Spencer Long.
Well, thank you. Referring back to the matter of the rule of law, we've got rules which govern the admissibility and probity of newly discovered evidence in obtaining a new trial. In Georgia, that standard is governed by a case called Timberlake, which sets out 6 conditions basically to establish the veracity and genuineness of the so-called new evidence. Not one of the affidavits on which the defense is building its main case here, or that his advocates generally emphasize, not one of them meets those conditions. Not one. One of the conditions, for an example, is that the newly discovered evidence can't be found now through a want of diligence earlier. In other words, you take my point.
Yeah.
But in this case, the affidavits of recantation at issue were finally obtained over the course of years. Finally, they were mostly gathered together at about 12 years after the conviction. The most simple and direct method that the criminal justice system provides for the introduction, the advancement of new evidence in order to get a new trial, is simply a motion for a new trial. Nothing surprising about that. Well, instead of filing a motion for a new trial in the trial court, which is where you would do it, they sat on these affidavits for about 5 years and didn't offer them. I think this was previously mentioned before. Didn't offer them until 8 days before the first scheduled execution last summer.
Let me interrupt. I know you've got more to say, but I wanted to bring some listeners into the conversation. Let's get Peter on the line. Peter's calling us from Winona in New Jersey.
Hi. Thank you for accepting my call.
Go ahead, please.
I am a forensic pathologist, and I have participated from time to time as a volunteer in the Innocence Project. I would like to say very simply the following. We have seen in over 100 cases, many of them death penalty cases, in which juries have erred. The system was broken. objective scientific evidence has shown that these people were innocent. Until we resolve that problem, those cases in which DNA is not available, we must give the same critique to those juries as we have demonstrated with DNA evidence. And until that is fixed, I do not believe that we should convict anyone.
I don't agree.
To the death penalty.
No, I'm sorry.
Unless there is absolutely no doubt. I like the term that was used by your prior representative here. I've forgotten the exact terms, moral.
Or lingering doubt, residual doubt. But Spencer Lawton, briefly, you disagree.
Well, with respect, I don't agree. The fact that scientific forensic evidence, DNA for an example, can and sometimes does establish actual innocence, that's not a reason to believe that we ought to treat contradictions in witness testimony as having the same certainty. The gentleman seems to suggest that we ought to treat any question about any evidence as we would treat affirmative evidence, DNA evidence of innocence, and that just, to my way of thinking, doesn't.
May I respond to that?
In just a moment, if you would, we're talking about the case of the death penalty of the execution now set for next week in Georgia. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Peter, briefly, if you would.
Yes, I am not referring to witness statements. I'm referring to the process. And I believe that if we're relying on juries, we must, until we improve the system, we can provide life imprisonment. I do not believe that we should execute anyone if we can show where there is scientific evidence how often juries have erred.
Perhaps I misunderstood.
All right, I just want to bring Jeffrey in on this.
Well, it's a very good point, and I have to say, even at this point in this fascinating conversation, I'm not sure whether I have a fair probability that a jury would have entertained reasonable doubt if they'd known about these recantations. I guess I'm still unsure about whether the two witness testimonies by themselves were enough to convict, whether there actually was physical evidence presented to the jurors. I know after the fact it was claimed that there was some physical evidence, but I do agree with the caller that, as with DNA evidence, you don't want there to be any real doubt when you're executing an innocent person, and either the Supreme Court standard is too high and Congress should change it, or else I'd like to hear right now why it is that we should not have doubt in the confidence of this verdict.
Peter, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And I'd like to thank Spencer Lawton for his time today. It's been interesting to speak with you. And again, I recommend if people go to our website to read the piece from the newspaper there.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being with you.
Spencer Lawton, Jr., the Chatham County District Attorney, believes Troy Davis's verdict is correct. And Jeffrey Rosen, before we let you go, the Supreme Court did consider another death penalty case from Georgia. There were some dissenting opinions about that, which raised some interesting issues about other cases in the future.
Yes, indeed. It was very interesting. This is Walker in Georgia. On Monday, the Supreme Court turned down the appeal, but there was a very interesting discussion between Justice Stevens and Justice Clarence Thomas. Stevens agreed the court shouldn't have heard the case, but he said state courts should compare these cases where you get the death penalty to other cases where death penalties are not imposed to make sure that the death penalty is not being imposed arbitrarily. Justice Thomas disagreed. He said you don't need proportionality review. The Constitution doesn't require that. Obviously, what's going on here is a question of whether race is a factor leading the death penalty to be disproportionately imposed. The Supreme Court famously ducked that question a couple of decades ago, and it may be on the verge of re-examining it. But for me, this Walker in Georgia discussion on Monday gives me a little more confidence in Troy Davis, because had the liberal justices like Justice Stevens, had serious doubt that an innocent man was being executed, they would have said so. They're not quiet, as this case today shows. So I'd have to believe that they weren't merely making a procedural ruling, but were not actually convinced that these recantations raise serious doubt about guilt.
And interesting, Justice John Paul Stevens, the question he was raising was the number of times when people are sentenced to death because the victim of the crime was white rather than necessarily that the perpetrator was of another race.
That's precisely right. And there was an extensive study presented to the Supreme Court, I think in the 1980s, where it was suggested that when victims are white, the death penalty is disproportionately imposed. The court refused to take that issue up. It's ducked it. Many people think, including Barack Obama, actually, as it happens, that this discriminatory imposition of the death penalty is the lingering shame of the American justice system. And Justice Stevens' attempt to resurrect that case on Monday suggests the court may be asked to see it again, and especially if there are new justices, this may be one of the great issues confronting the case in the coming couple of years.
Jeffrey Rosen, always nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Rosen, law professor at George Washington University. His most recent book, The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. He was with us here in 3A. At this moment, Troy Davis sentenced to be executed next week. The last court of appeal is the governor, Sonny Perdue, who could issue a commutation or a pardon if he so desires, but as we've heard, probably not likely.